This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 10th of June, these are our main stories. Demonstrators clash with police in Hong Kong in protests over a new extradition law. Voting has ended in Kazakhstan's presidential election with hundreds of people arrested. Security forces in Sudan clash with opposition activists on the first day of a campaign of civil disobedience. Also in this podcast...
Crocodiles, tigers, lions, they don't deserve to die even though they are wild.
It is rare to see many wild animals because hunters have been killing them.
We hear from the children in Cameroon campaigning to protect the country's wildlife. We begin this podcast in Hong Kong, where hundreds of thousands of people have been taking part in demonstrations, bringing parts of the city to a standstill. They're protesting against a proposed new extradition law, which they believe could be used by Beijing to target political opponents. Many refuse to disperse in defiance of a deadline. Our China correspondent Robin Brandt reports.
Estimates of the number of people on the streets of Hong Kong vary from 250,000 to just over a million.
Say no to the evil bill.
Almost all are dressed in white. It's overwhelmingly peaceful. Their worry is a new law that would allow people to be extradited to the Chinese mainland, where the courts are not impartial and people can be imprisoned for their politics.
If the Hong Kong government extradite its people, then China breach its promise. There's nothing Hong Kong government can do. So there is no way that Hong Kong citizens should trust the Chinese government and the Hong Kong government.
China government is trying to control over Hong Kong and also trying to make sure that Hong Kong people keep silence and follow their orders.
People like myself, expats, are really, really cautious about this type of thing, thinking that China could actually come and impose tit-for-tat kind of arrests.
Hong Kong's new extradition law was controversial from the minute it was proposed. Supporters say it will target criminals taking refuge in Hong Kong. Critics, though, see it as a further erosion of the judicial independence of the former British colony. The region's chief executive, its most senior politician, said the new law had built-in protection to ensure it didn't target people for political or religious reasons. But sceptics see yet more evidence, 22 years after China regained sovereignty, of a hastening end to Hong Kong's cherished different system.
One of the marchers, Agnes Chow, is a member of a pro-democracy organisation advocating self-determination for Hong Kong.
We almost occupied many of the main roads in the Hong Kong Island District near the government headquarters because there were too many people joining the rally today. Even for me, personally, I live in the suburb. When I want to take the bus to go to where the rally started, I couldn't get into the bus because they are already full of people who want to join the march today. So many of the citizens have to wait for a long time for taking the public transport to join the rally today because there were too many people. Many people were very angry and they came out because they want to protect our home, which is Hong Kong. The police actually used a lot of way to try to stop people from going to the protest. For example, they only opened up half of the roads and they opened only half of the Victoria Park, which is the starting point of the rally, to let people gather there. But actually it is not enough for people to gather because there were too many people. That's why many participants shout out slogans to impose pressure to the police force, and finally, the police decided to open up more roads and more parts of the Victoria Park to let protesters together.
Agnes Chow in Hong Kong. To Kazakhstan now.
Astana!
Sounds from the street protests in the capital, Nur Sultan, where the police have arrested hundreds of people. They were protesting against Sunday's presidential election, which they say was not at all free. And Kazakhstan's interim president, Kasym Jomart Tokayev, is almost certain to be confirmed as the country's new leader. This protester expressed some of that feeling.
For 30 years, we have been lied. This election is illegal. For 30 years we were patient, now we are not going to be patient. Many people now is in jail. People are afraid to go out on the street. Now the patience is gone. We are not going to be patient anymore.
Our Central Asia correspondent Rayhan Dimitri, who's in Nur Sultan, gave us this update.
Polls have closed and voting stopped in these presidential elections. Already we have some figures from the Central Election Commission. They said that over 70% of voters cast their ballots in today's election. But this Sunday election wasn't really about the candidates or the normal things that usually apply when it comes to presidential elections. It didn't go smooth at all. There were protests in the capital, Nur Sultan, which, by the way, was renamed after the country's first president, Nursultan Nazarbayev, who resigned back in March. And his resignation kind of largely triggered everything what's happening in the country now. There were also detentions in Kazakhstan's largest city of Almaty. We were at the scene. We saw how police were really kind of heavy-handedly dispersing these protesters. There was riot police. They were creating a lot of noise, banging on their shields and kind of pushing the protesters. They were also saying that this protest was unsanctioned, therefore these detentions and arrests were justified.
So hundreds of people arrested. Will these protests have made any difference to the final result, though?
Probably no. But if you look into the context where these protests are happening, this is really kind of very unusual for Kazakhstan. There have been protests, to be fair, in the past. In 2016, there were mass protests against the land reform. One of the biggest fears among Kazakhs is all these deals that their country government is doing with China. There were protests in the past, but protests so openly during the elections, it's really happening. I don't remember it, you know, it's happening for the first time in a long time. So these people who came out to protest today, they were talking about the problems in their lives. They were saying that their country is rich in natural resources, in oil and gas, but ordinary people don't really see benefits of all these riches that their country has. And they were accusing the authorities of just stealing the wealth of the people.
So the election is over. Are the protests going to stop?
I can only refer to what I heard from the protesters today, and they were saying that this is only the beginning, that people are really fed up, that by creating this atmosphere of fear, all these detentions and so on, that this will not stop the people because they want genuine changes.
Rayhan Dimitri in Kazakhstan. The Qatari foreign minister is in London holding talks with representatives from the Iranian and American governments. The purpose is to try to de-escalate rising tensions between Washington and Tehran in the Gulf. The White House has recently reimposed economic sanctions on Iran, and the US has an aircraft carrier and other warships patrolling the region. Our correspondent Lise Doucette told me more.
The Qatari foreign minister was in London this afternoon and he briefed a small group of reporters. And of course, we asked him about the rising tensions in the Persian Gulf because Qatar is in this position where it worries about the rising escalation. Like other countries in the Gulf, it doesn't want a war. It would have a devastating consequence for the region. But Qatar, because of the blockade imposed by some of its neighbors, has a relationship with Iran now. So it has been speaking to Iran about trying to find a way out. And Qatar also has a strong relationship with the United States, so it's also been speaking to the United States. And so he emphasized to us about, he'd been pointing out the obvious, that everybody says They don't want a war, but nobody seems to be finding a path forward in order to try to find a way out. And this is the beginning of what some are calling a week of diplomacy on Iran. Germany's foreign minister goes to Tehran tomorrow and is expecting to see the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani. Then on Wednesday, the prime minister of Japan, Shinzo Abe, is going. And of course, he just hosted President Trump in Japan and is believed to be carrying messages from the United States. President Trump, of course, has offered talks with the Iranians, but the Iranians say the conditions have to be right, including lifting the sanctions that the US has been imposing on the Islamic Republic.
So realistically, what chance is there of Iranian and US representatives actually meeting?
Well, there is a proposal, and we understand that it's one of the proposals that the Japanese leader may float with the Iranians, is for President Trump and President Rouhani to meet on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. Now, that is a few months away, but a lot would have to happen. President Trump, of course, wants to see the kind of summit with the Iranians that he had with the North Koreans, but Iran is a very different country than North Korea. North Korea benefited, Kim Jong-un benefited from being seen to be on the world stage with President Trump, whereas in Iran, relations with the United States are deeply controversial, and therefore Iran simply can't have a summit for the sake of a summit. And it certainly can't do it while the United States has pulled out of the landmark nuclear deal and continues to impose crippling sanctions that are having such a huge impact on the Iranian economy and society.
Lee Stusset. It's 50 years since the first astronauts landed on the moon, but for all the excitement of that event, the efforts leading up to it are sometimes overlooked. A lot fell by the wayside en route, and one of those things was a module used a couple of months earlier.
160 to go.
You're burning.
To go.
You're burning.
78 to go. 50 to go. 20 to go. Stand by, Tom. Oh, beautiful.
Charlie Brown, Houston, he got the burn off. We're in good shape.
Outstanding.
Okay.
Congratulations to Snoopy.
The sound there of the launch of that module, Snoopy, in 1969. Now, 5 decades after it was jettisoned into space, astronomers believe they found it. Terry Egan has been following developments.
This is a lunar module. It was used by Apollo 10. Now, of course, as you know, the Apollo program was America's big effort to land a man on the moon before 1970. And they did that with Neil Armstrong and Apollo 11 in 1969. But this came just before that, 2 months before. So this was the module used in that mission. It was called Snoopy, as you said, and it was named after the popular cartoon dog. And it was a practice module. Two of the three astronauts of Apollo 10 transferred into it, and they went to within 15,000 metres above the moon's surface. And it showed it could be done. And they then returned in the module to Apollo 10, at which point it was jettisoned into space and forgotten about. It was too heavy to bring back. And up until now, it was believed to be lost forever in 900 million kilometres of space. They didn't know where it was or what had happened to it.
But now they think they found it.
Well, yes, this search, it began in 2011. It was begun by a team led by Nick Howes. He's a fellow of the Royal Astronomical Society here in Britain. And he initially calculated the odds of locating it at 235 million to one.
Wow.
So you can see that difficulty. But he and his team analysed terabytes of radar data, and they've located what they believe to be Snoopy. It's 98% sure, but of course they can't be certain until someone gets up close to it. Now, some have said, why bother? But from the viewpoint of space archaeology, this is really important. The Apollo program was the greatest technological achievement in human history. As you remember, when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, he said it was one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Well, this was a kind of a baby step to that goal coming before. And as for what's next, well, they're going to try and get close enough to confirm that it is Snoopy. They even hope to get it back. And Nick Howes has said an ideal candidate for doing that might be Elon Musk. He, of course, is the super wealthy founder of SpaceX, and apparently he's a big Apollo nerd. So over to you, Elon.
Terry Egan, and I'm sure he'll be back with an update in due course. Cameroon is one of the places that has a rich biodiversity, but its reputation for protecting that wildlife is less impressive. The illegal bushmeat trade has already wiped out some of the rarest animal species that were found only in Cameroon. But a campaign to change attitudes is underway. Our reporter Randy Jo Sarr reports from the town of Limbe.
Limbe, fondly called the City of Friendship, is a bustling seaside town in southwest Cameroon. Famous for black sandy beaches, botanic gardens, lively people, and of course, spicy roast fish. But it is also a destination for people with big appetite for bushmeat.
There is one lady around my neighborhood who prepares bushmeat every Sunday, unfailingly. I just go there and eat every Sunday. Sometimes we eat grass cutters, deer, and porcupine. I don't eat gorilla.
Well, I think that bush meat is one of the best meat. It's very, very good for consumption.
Wow, only the flavor that comes from the bush meat, the way it is being prepared, you would definitely want to have a taste of it. So many of us, we even prefer the bush meat.
Wildlife officials are battling poachers who are wiping out Cameroon's emblematic wildlife. Protected species that are rescued are taken to the Limbe Wildlife Center. I'm here to meet Victor Veseke Njonje, who has put in over 30 years caring for chimps and other rescued wildlife.
When you keep on killing these animals like this, it's not good. Some of them have been in people's houses, like pets and so on. This is the best place to bring them, so that we can take care of them, we feed them, have big space, they can play, interact, have friends.
The director of the center, Guillaume Leforique, is also head of Pondrilus, an international NGO working for wildlife protection. He is behind a new behavioral change campaign to protect wildlife.
If we start at least to engage people, maybe some of them will realize, oh, what are we doing actually? There are other species that are about to go. So how should I, as a citizen, try to do something to stop this from my country, from my region, from my city to disappear? Because this is ours, this is our richness.
In song and dance, the people of Limbe take part in the launch of an innovative behavioral change campaign towards wildlife. The mystic master, Ngwese Koge, is one of the campaigners.
The cheetahs are not there. They have already disappeared completely in Cameroon. And now the elephant is being threatened. The pangolin is being threatened because of that. So we are teaching the children today because we know they will also transfer the knowledge tomorrow, and that's how wildlife will be protected.
These young wildlife ambassadors have embraced the campaign.
I know baboons, crocodiles, tigers, lions, and other animals in the world, but they don't deserve to die even though they are wild.
It is rare to see many wild animals because hunters have been killing them. They kill elephants to use elephant tusks.
Here at Mile One, the gateway into Limbe, about a dozen giant billboards planted along the highway are being unveiled. They show different wildlife, extinct or threatened, and the message, protect wildlife. Henceforth, visitors cruising into town, even those looking out for bushmeat delicacies, will not miss the warnings.
Randy Jo Sarr in Cameroon. Still to come in this podcast, the singing grannies celebrating the collapse of the right-wing Austrian government.
I always meet younger people who are coming and saying, oh, the cool grannies. The right-wing are saying, well, these old stupid women, they should go home. And
the security forces in Sudan have fired tear gas and live ammunition to disperse crowds of protesters, killing four people. Most offices and businesses in the capital, Khartoum, are closed as part of a campaign of civil disobedience aimed at pressuring the military to hand over power to a civilian authority. The action was called after the security forces killed dozens of people when they broke up a protest camp last week. Our Africa editor, Fergal Keane, is in Khartoum and has sent this report on Sunday's casualties.
It felt as if the entire neighbourhood of Bahri had come to grieve for Walid Abd el-Rahman.
The keening of the women could be heard all along the dusty street, from his family home, past the mosque where he prayed, and the grove of trees where his friends were sheltering from the sun, to the first of the barricades where other young men kept watch for roaming militia troops. 37-year-old Walid had been manning a barricade when a militia sniper shot him early this morning. Among those attending his funeral was Ahmed Hadra, a leading member of the opposition Forces for Freedom and Change.
The great fear right now that is still there is so many killings. It's all over. No one can go outside his home and feel safe. Anyone, younger or older.
Today marked the first phase of the campaign of civil disobedience called by the opposition, largely an attempt to shut down the cities by asking supporters to stay at home. This should have been a busy business day, but we drove along empty street after street where businesses were shut. In northern Khartoum, we met a group of young men acting as defenders of their district. One swung a machete in the air above his head. They'd built a barricade of rocks across a two-lane road. "They've beaten us and they've beaten out our souls," one man told me. "We don't know how to sleep at night. What they're doing isn't logical." The root cause of this crisis, the military's refusal to cede power to civilians, shows no sign of being addressed. It was obvious today that despite nearly a week of terror, there's still a spirit of protest. The revolution is fighting for its life.
Fergal Keane in Khartoum. Britain's former Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson says that if he becomes Prime Minister, he will refuse to pay the UK's so-called divorce bill to leave the European Union. Mr Johnson is currently the front-runner to succeed Theresa May as leader of the Conservative Party and therefore as Prime Minister. Our political correspondent Rob Watson believes Mr Johnson's proposals are unlikely to happen.
I think it's certainly the case that the European Union would like UK payments to continue in one form or another, certainly what it owes, but I don't think it's realistic for three reasons. The European Union has said it won't renegotiate. I think it looks at the UK and thinks, goodness gracious, this is a country weaker, chaotic and more divided than ever. And three, I think Boris Johnson would be toxic because he has said all sorts of incredibly disobliging things about EU leaders and EU officials, likening them to camp commandants during the Second World War. And an awful lot of European Union leaders think of him as someone who's sort of utterly ill-suited to high office.
Toxic, perhaps, but he's the favourite still, isn't he?
Yes, I mean, I think there's a difference between him being the favourite amongst his party activists, which he absolutely is, and being a man with all sorts of baggage. I mentioned the way in which an awful lot of foreign leaders see him as utterly ill-suited to high office. That's also something that some Conservative MPs think. But I'd throw in two other strikes against him, and that is, you know, 48% of the voters can't stand him as a result of the EU referendum. And, of course, he famously said F business. We know what F stands for, and Conservative Party is supposed to be the party of business, so an uphill struggle. Whoever wins this, it will be the most poisoned of poison chalices, Jamie. I mean, the country is even more divided about Brexit than it was 3 years ago. The Conservative Party is deeply divided. Businesses, and I think the international community is now profoundly sceptical about Brexit, whether it could ever be made a success. But there it is. You still have them all competing to have that job. You often wonder why, but of course it is the appeal of being in number 10 Downing Street. I mean, if you're a politician, you want to be Prime Minister, no matter how dire things look.
Rob Watson talking to James Kumarasamy. The International Labour Organization, which is celebrating its centenary, begins its annual assembly on Monday. This year, the organisation, which brings together trades unions, government leaders and employers, will be discussing policy on sexual discrimination in the workplace and the future of work in an increasingly digital world. Imogen Folkes reports from Geneva.
Founded in the wake of the First World War, when workers everywhere were demanding better treatment, the ILO has been defending workers' rights for 100 years, despite regular suggestions from some governments that, in the 21st century, the organisation may no longer really be necessary. Today, government leaders are in Geneva to honour the centenary. Angela Merkel, François Macron, Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. On the agenda are some very 21st century issues: jobs, artificial intelligence and digitalisation. and a proposed convention on sexual harassment in the workplace. That last is expected to be especially controversial.
Imogen, folks. It's been a tumultuous few weeks in Austrian politics. The coalition of the Conservatives and the far-right Freedom Party has collapsed after a video sting involving the far-right leader Heinz Christian Strache. He was secretly filmed, apparently offering public contracts in return for political and financial support. A number of Austrians are upset, but others are celebrating, including a protest group known as the Grannies Against the Right. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
This is the song of the Grannies, the Omas, as they're known in German. Omas, Omas, they sing. We fight for the children and for resistance. The Omas gegen Rechts is one of Austria's newest protest groups, formed to oppose Austria's last government, an alliance of the conservatives and the far right. These days they're celebrating after the collapse of the coalition. At a demonstration in Vienna, I met Eva, one of the Omas.
We're here to celebrate the end of the former government. In fact, we're here also to have a kind of party, because colleagues from my group were demonstrating every Thursday, and they didn't care if it was raining, snowing or storm. We were on the street, we were loud, and we're quite content. And in fact, we're coming here to show, not to manifest, but to celebrate.
Quite a lot of different groups represented here at this demo, but you can clearly spot the Omas in their brightly coloured knitted caps. Susanne Scholl, a writer and former foreign correspondent, says it's important to show that older women have a voice.
Elder women are never really taken into account. People think that you should go home and wait for dying. And we wanted just to have our word in the politics and to say we don't agree with the direction in which Austria is going, and we want a free, tolerant and respectful Austria for our children and our grandchildren. And that's why we started with grannies.
How do people react to you?
People react really positively. I always meet younger people who are coming and saying, "Oh, the cool grannies." The right wing are saying, "Well, these old stupid women, they should go home." And this, we had one who said, "Wenn man länger lebt, als man nützlich ist." So when you live longer, then you are useful. Which is really Nazi rhetoric. But these are more in the social medias. But on the street, people are nice to us. I mean, you don't go against grannies.
And the idea is spreading in Germany and via their international Facebook group. In Austria, the far right may be out of power, but the Omas say they'll keep on demonstrating.
I think it's planned to continue till the elections in September, because representatives of the former government left, but the problems are still there, and a lot of laws they decided are still there we are not content with.
We know why we are against a right government, with abortion and all these old things. It's like a rollback. It is, the time goes back in dark, dark times.
Bethany Bell. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.